Succession number 27226, Reel 21.
Reel 21.
Right, well, we've now got away with this sort of ferry trip. It's been aborted, and we've come back via, I picked up by a Fulmer, and we flew back to Port Reitz and carried on our normal work. And that's maintained. I did an ASV test for a swordfish and took it back to Port Reitz as part of the job. And the first job I had was an anti-submarine patrol for Frobisher. And then later on, I had occasion to take the captain of the Frobisher at that time on another flight of the swordfish, where he was to Nairobi from Port Reitz again in a swordfish. Now, why I took him to Nairobi, I do not know, but it's rather strange that Commander Lewin ultimately was with me. He was not the Commander Lewin I thought he was, because in fact it was Terry Lewin who ultimately became the Admiral of the Fleet, Lord Lewin, in peacetime. And in point of fact, I didn't realise it at the time, but we were together again at the Whale Island when he was on the long gunnery course for promotion, and I was on the long gunnery course for promotion for flying. And so our paths are crossed together, and we didn't realise it when I was at Port Reitz. And it's only by doing this recording now that I've suddenly been able to put the two together, because I documented in my book. Anyway, oh dear, that coffee's awful. Never mind. It was now then, from then on, for a week or two, October, I was flying markers, water landings, fighter directs and ISIS, and exercises generally, all the way through until it's time to go back, I think, to the flight back to West Africa, which took place on the November the 22nd, really started. This is really the start of the trip back, the ferry trip across to the desert, going back up by various routes. And I set off, I knew that I was going about the 22nd of November, but I started the trip by catching a Lockheed Lodestar with the RAF, I think, with passengers, going from up to Eastleigh, and then to Juba and Malakal, and then to Khartoum, where I spent the night in Khartoum, and joined a short C-class flying boat coming back down the old route that they were just developing for the British Air, the BOAC later on, and they were route proving Khartoum right down through the lakes and the Albert Lake, cross using the lakes with the flying boat all the time, and following all the way back to West Africa, literally using a flying boat to land on the rivers on the way, which was quite a unique experience in many ways.
What was it like to fly in the flying boat?
Well, it was just like a... Well, that was interesting, because it was just like an ordinary civil airline. It was, in fact, a civil airline, except in this particular case, strangely enough, I found out later, we were playing cards most of the way, and we were sitting over the bullion locker. And it's interesting, it's an interesting story of in relation to that, that we were actually going down through the Congo in a slightly different way to get where we had to go, and coming back through the desert. But on the reinforcement route, a lot of Poles were flying from the desert, from Cairo, all the way down virtually the route we're going. It's not through the Belgian Congo, to West Africa. and it was illegal to buy gold or anything else. And what was happening, they changed their money all the way around, made a profit on changing the money. And when they got to West Africa, they bought as much gold as they could lay their hands on, and it was illegal, but they were doing it, and flying all the way back and selling the gold in Cairo, which went straight back to Germany. It was not deliberate, it was just they were doing a trade, they sold the gold in Cairo, and it got out of its way. It went presumably through, north, I think, to probably Turkey or somewhere like that, and went back to Germany. And that was one of the aspects of the reinforcement route, that people were working the route and they were making money at it. They were flying the aircraft, of course, but wherever they stopped, where they got ashore for a little while, they could change the money, and you could change it advantageously, both going down and coming back. And a very interesting thing, because when you got away from really England and Kenya and going down through the Belgian Congo and the native states there, the money was rather different, because they came in wads, stapled together with a staple, and you tore them off a piece at a time. And we were playing poker on the way with all these paper notes, and we were going to play poker with a pile of paper in front of us. It looked like a lot of money. We got it all together. It was worth about £2. You know, it's absolutely quite crazy. That was one aspect of it. But as part of that exercise, you changed your money as you went into a country and dropped down and stayed overnight and made a bob or two. And so it went on all the way through. So we set off. I went back up to... Khartoum, and as I believe I've already said, I was with this Italian pilot who had already flown regularly during the war in the desert from southern Italy. I can't remember the place now, but I think Bari, somewhere around there, right the way to Addis Ababa, not knowing what the weather was like to bite there. And I can assure you that the weather in the wrong time of year in Addis Ababa is not very pleasant. So that's right. That was dealing with this Italian pilot. He was beautifully spoken, quite young, probably about 28 to 30s. And that was an exercise that I saw at later on when I flew back to Addis Ababa in the civil aircraft later after the war, and I arrived there in the middle of the rains. And was encapsulated in the airport for 3 days. We couldn't get out of the airport. It was just siling down. It really was wet. And to get into, when we flew into the airfield at Addis Ababa, we were flying through cloud with the mountains sticking out of them. And it's quite a hairy experience. And he must not have known what that was going to be like when he set off to get to Addis Ababa. And then that was before our time, because the war had finished there. In fact, the...
It's 41, wasn't it, really? Finished really in 41.
The 41. One of the cars, the... I can't remember the story. We had, when I was in East Africa, one of the cars there, quite a famous Italian car, owned by the... consulate or whatever it was, a very senior Italian person, was taken over as loot, and we had it up in the repair yard at Nairobi, and we also had on strength in the squadron, though I never saw it, a Savoia Machete that he flew, and that was brought down and was part of our squadron. It's recorded in the squadron files. Enough of that. We've got down to the stage where we're flying just civil really, in a Lodestar. I've got a captain, there's a Captain Mollard of BOAC. So that was a short, that was a C-class. First air for Barton. They were actually flying Lockheed Lodestars. With hindsight now, after all these years, you suddenly realise that the Americans were flying, from Cairo down to Juba, Malakal, and back to Kenya, to Nairobi, with American aircraft which weren't flying boats. So to go between Nairobi and Khartoum, you could go in an ordinary boat. But if you wanted to go westabout, to go to West Africa, you had to use flying boats. There was no landing strips that a civil aircraft could fly on. It's just an aspect of civil flying. It's rather interesting.
When you landed on the lakes with the flying boat, what kind of facilities were there for refueling and generally just maintaining the aircraft or things like that? What were the staging posts?
Do you know, I have no recollection. I know that some of the type, but the as I go through the list, I can probably I don't know of any service sitting in the aircraft in transit. And when but it obviously it didn't take us many days to go across. Anyway, we'll look at that in a second. So we set off. Then we caught the back onto BOAC, having gone up to Khartoum to come back all the way down, but going westabout. So that takes us really to a C-class of Mollard. We went from one trip, that was the Khartoum to Malacca to Stanley. In one trip, on November the 30th, we went from Khartoum to Stanleyville on the Congo, which was quite a long haul. We did Stanley and Cocky Hatville and Cocky Helford to Low Airportville. In other words, by the 1st of December, we'd actually got back to Libreville and the end of Belgian Congo before we went up to Lagos and to Nigeria. So that was a very interesting exercise. It took 3 days, December the 1st at Libreville, Cocky Hatville and the other bits and pieces. Interesting there was the things that you knew about that you'd never possibly see in a lifetime was the activities on the Congo. And there was a Sandy the Great, Sandy the Strong, maker of laws, writer of wrong, was quite a famous song at that time. And it was all based, really, about that part of the world in Stanleyville, where the natives still sang it when we went there. And that was interesting exercises, because ahead of the Stanley Falls, which people probably know about by geography, which are quite monumental falls, really, above the level of the falls, the natives are fishing. And they fished for, Nile perch or something like that? Big, big fish. And just above the falls, they had stuck poles into the stones and ground below, and they strung fibre baskets into the tide, and they worked on the top of these, and carrying these big Nile perch, they must have been, 2 or 3 foot long, very, very big fish, and they were alive and flipping, and if they fell in the water and they started to swim, they went over on the end of the cliff. And they were also sailing canoes at the top end there. And in my logbook, I've shown before, during and after. That's quite an interesting aspect of that life. And you became engaged with something that was part of the cinema trade at that time, very popular, and you recognise that. Then we shot off down the... one can talk about the situation there, but it's very dim now. And we ended up going to the end of the run, which was to Cocky Hatville, I think, was the next place. And, I'm wasting time again. Went to Libreville, which was Belgian Congo. And they were quite pleasant people. It was quite a civilized sort of life and quite wealthy. It's a bit different now, I'm afraid. And went to Libreville in the French Equatorial Africa, and then to Gabon with that stops. And they were stops in the flying boat on the river and taking off on the river. Before that, we used the Albert Lakes in the early part of the trip. So I then left there and went ashore into Lagos. Interesting point there, that for me, from a personal point of view, there's a good surfing beach in just off Lagos, and the first surfing experience I had was to do surfing with a mahogany board, which is about 6 foot long, which is just a plank, and if you get in the sea like that and you're running into the coast, you're sitting on, laying flat across this plank, and suddenly you run out of water and hit the sand, and that went all the way from the tip of my toes right away up my body and took all my skin off. That was just a crude piece of... that was one experience I well remember. That was Lagos. We didn't stay there very long, and we within 4 or 5 days. And I don't remember staying in Lagos, but obviously we had a first social because we were going swimming and that sort of thing. And I stayed there for another 5 days, and then we went by SS Thursville from Lagos to Takoradi on the Gold Coast, to Secondi, actually, which was a transit port for all the aircraft which started on the reinforcement route going the same way that we went back again. Interesting thing there was that the Takoradi airfield was, in fact, an old mangrove swamp that had been dried out, and it was a dead level flat. But between the mangrove swamp that was and the sea was an upstand, a bund, which would be about 30 foot high. And the camp was on the top of that bund in the normal traditional huts. And outside, you go to the edge of what was effectively a cliff. And outside all your bunks were a lot of holes going down, and you could look down there, right down those holes, and you could see the beach at the bottom of these holes. And in the morning, all the snakes came out. It was full of snakes, and they used to come out, and the sun came out, and you had the huts there, and there were hundreds of snakes all the way along the front of this, where they came out. Never bothered you at all. Big one, not, there were pythons, I think, the big ones anyway, all the big ones and little ones. And you would look down there, and you could see down this hole, and you see nothing alive at all, right down to, the sun was shining on the sand on the beach, you could see the sun shining into the cave at the bottom. Quite interesting. We stayed there for a little while to take the swordfish back, and I wanted something to take home, and looking for something unique, and I managed to buy, after a lot of searching, a table. And it was a typical mahogany table, a shanty stool with little tables, with little elephants with stools on the bottom, so about 2 foot high. And I went and looked all over the place for them. And I finally found somebody who made them, and I went into a storeroom there where there were hundreds of these things, all great chunks of mahogany. And there wasn't a decent one there. They're all dried out and cracked. And that's the one that I got, which I found later on outside the shop just before I was leaving. I paid nothing for it. And that is probably unique in that that's one chunk of mahogany. And I took it to pieces. And my engineer in my aircraft sat on that in pieces all the way back from Takoradi on the Gold Coast back to Mombasa. It's nice. It's a lovely piece. Okay, it's rather nice, isn't it? And so that's that really deals with Lagos. Lagos is quite an interesting place. It was then quite populous, but I gather it's a bit more populous now. But it was quite a civilized place, and where the English had settled in West Africa, the situations were probably better than anywhere else. The natives, for all they dressed in rags, were still seemed better treated. They seemed better off anyway. So off we go. So we did the test on Takoradi on the 7th, leaving to go back to Commander on the Gold Coast, Accra, and all the way across the southern route. We got caught at Minna, I think. It was. It took us to get to northern Nigeria, and then Minna. We got to. It took us another 3 days because the Harmattan was down, and this meant that the sand or the the dust in the air made it impossible almost to fly, because you're flying in a goldfish bowl. You know, it was a moving goldfish bowl across the ground, and you just had to fly by dead wreck and hoping that the other end you'd come out all right. And so we had to stop for 3 days there. That was at Ikeja. That's just at the bottom end of the reinforced route, just out of Lagos, probably three or four hundred miles. And from there we went to Minna, which is right in the centre of Nigeria, just a major stopping off point. And with the next step, which was the same day, December the 12th, we went to Kano, which is the old place where the Queen of Sheba went. And I still don't understand how the Queen of Sheba always came across to West Africa. But the prominent thing there was that the dyeing industry, they used to dye the clothes. They're very famous for cloth dyeing. And when we arrived there, we arrived late at night, and they kept the airfield open for us. There was a native there that when the airfield had to be cleared, he stood there with a bloody great big horn and blew it, so all the natives went off the field and the aircraft could land. And they knew we were coming, and they kept everything open. All the shops were open for three aircraft, and to sell us anything they could. And we bought a lot of leather. Leather was quite a prominent thing in those days. In fact, later on after the war, I was offered a job actually in Kano by the United Africa Company, which is Levers, purely and simply in the leather business there. But I didn't take it. My wife didn't like the heat, so that sorted that one out. So that was fine. Kano was interesting. Minna was just a quick stop off and a cup of tea and a cup of coffee. We then went to Maiduguri, which is just on the outskirts of Nigeria, just before we go into French territory. Now, one aspect of all this that sticks in my mind particularly was that we had trouble with the French when we were in Freetown. And in fact, the RAF actually stopped down in Diawatin. But they were the Vichy French that I visited later on when peace broke out, when I was in West Africa. They were not too bad in West Africa. But when we got to the Vichy French occupants of the various French territories and the airfields as we're going across the desert, they were dealing with Vichy French. And they were very, very unhelpful at all, no question at all. They did not like us. And this is where we came into the first lot. We dropped into Fort Lamy, and I don't know how long that journey was. That was Maiduguri to Fort Lamy was only a couple of hours. It was a relatively short trip. But from Kano to Maiduguri was 3 hours, 30 minutes, which was a fair old haul. But that I remember very little about Maiduguri, because I think we continued on that same day. Let's have a quick look. Oh no, we stayed at Maiduguri. I can't remember it at all. Can't remember anything about it. We stayed there. That must have been the Hamatan, of course. That was probably the weather. And we stayed there, and we went from Maiduguri to Fort Lamy, which was the first of the Four Legion outposts which we came across. And that was okay, because it was really touch and go. I don't think we had to. We didn't refuel there. That would be right. So if we didn't refuel there, we don't have 1 hour and 40 minutes, so we didn't need any fuel. But the next trip from Fort Lamy to Ati was another two and a half hours. So we'd done 4 hours flying in the Swordfish when we got to Ati. Itself is, again, something quite different. First of all, the airfield had been supplied with fuel a long time ago, and it was all laid there in very rusty drums. And we could only recognise the airfield because of the drums, because there were bumps on the ground. Everything was just sandy, just like the rest of the country. Obviously, there was habitation near it, but I can't remember what it looked like. But it was a French Friedel outpost anyway, so it was probably rough. The French all there had the native women around, and we landed at Ati to be greeted by a foreign legionnaire, an officer with a teepee and his thing down the back of his neck. And I can speak a little bit of French, but not very good French. And he stood there while we arrived, did nothing to help us, just stood there. Nobody else to help us at all. And I went up to this frog. I went up to him, he didn't come out to see me at all. And said, Monsieur, où est l'essence? And he went, là. And pointed to these rusty old oil drums, the drums there. And turned around and walked away. And that's all we had. We had to tip out fuel from those 40-gallon drums into buckets, if I remember right. I think we weren't buckets, they were flimsies, they were square flimsies. And we had to refuel three swordfish in Ati at 12 o'clock midday in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and there were nowhere hotter. And there were 9 of us altogether. There's three, is that right? Eight. No, we only had eight. Pilots, observers, and crew. Eight or nine, anyway. And we had to refuel these completely by hand. They gave us a Zwicky pump, but we couldn't use because it was too slow. And we rolled the oil drums out, piled them up, so we could roll the oil drums round, so the petrol just poured out into the slimsies. And then we had to carry it all the way up to the top of the aircraft. And if you've seen a swordfish, it's a big airplane, and fill it from five, what is effective 5 gallons, through a chamois leather to take all the water out, to fill the aircraft. And that took us forever in the middle of the day. And then the next trip was a long one. I think it was, I remember that one was pretty nasty. That was 3 hours. We had to do that from about 1 o'clock. It took us probably two to three hours. And then we had to get to the next field before it closed down. Because if it closed down, the only illumination had there, it wasn't lights all the way around, it was a paraffin glim at the end of the runway, and you went for that one, saw the paraffin glim, landed there, and that was it. So Ati was an experience and a half, and it showed that we were fit, because you imagine, 5 gallons, and I think a tank held 85 gallons, if I remember rightly. And that's four drums we'd taken out into flimsies, carried over to the aircraft, lift it up probably 10 feet more, and then stand there while you're pouring it in through chamois leathers, which is a long time to go through the chamois. That was to get the water out, and then back again. And there was nobody to fill them. It was all nine people doing that total. That was an exercise and a half. And I'll tell you, you knew you'd done it when you got it. That was something. We finally got away, probably, if I remember rightly, about 3 o'clock, about 3:30 in the afternoon, about that time. But we knew that it was getting a bit hairy because it began to dark when we got to the next one, which was sort of, it's Fort Lamiati, El Janina.